Welcome to the Redesign Your Mind podcast, where we have real conversations around mental health, self-improvement, and how we can find more meaning in our lives. I'm your host, Stefan Moralia. The podcast is loosely inspired by my book, Redesign Your Mind, Tools and Inspiration for Positive Mental Health, which is available on Amazon, Kindle, iTunes, and Audible. Please refer to the show notes for more information, including a disclaimer and how you can get in contact with me. Thanks for listening. Hey guys, today on the show I have Dr. Hannah Carell, who is a psychologist and author. Her upcoming book is called How to Break Up with Friends, and really looking forward to asking her a few questions about, first of all, being a psychologist, and second of all, about this book, How to Break Up with Friends. So, when do we need to do that? And what else can we do in that sense too? So, really looking forward to the chat. Hope you guys like it. Hannah, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. Great to have you on board. And we've got a full agenda of things to talk about.
Thanks, Steph. It's so nice to be here. It's so great to chat with you, and Happy New Year, Happy Christmas.
Well, that's right. We've got a few days left of this year. So I'm sure a lot of people are looking forward to 2021. That's for sure.
Now, put 2020 behind us.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess to kick things off, so much to talk about today, but I'll get you just spend a few minutes telling the listeners and watchers about your background, and I guess a brief intro, and what led you onto this path of becoming a psychologist and writing the book, How to Break Up with Friends.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I am a psychologist, as you know. So I grew up in Canberra, and I started down the track of doing my Bachelor of Science in Psychology at UC, University of Canberra. And while I was doing that, they often say to you, if you want to get good experience to help you get into honours and masters, it's good to try out things like Lifeline. So I went and did counselling at Lifeline Australia. And that was really amazing experience, learning about, suicide interventions, things like that. And then from there, I went on to get into honours, which was just, if you have any psychology students listening right now, like, kudos to you. My heart goes out to you, because it is really hard to do psychology. It can be really soul destroying. So hang in there. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. So I did my honours. I moved to Melbourne and went and did neuropsychology. So I did a master's in neuropsychology at University of Melbourne. And I also was a glutton for punishment, and I went and did a PhD in neuroscience, which is looking at neuroimaging of the brain as well. So I really, really like the brain.
Okay, this is amazing. So clearly got a lot of smarts about you, and a lot of knowledge that you've learned over time. So but what set you on that path? Why did you want to take on all that pain and all that work to all that study?
Why did you choose it? Well, I think when I was a child, I always used to feel an affinity towards people. I was a very empathetic kid. I grew up in a family of five children. So I have a bunch of sisters and one brother. And I was a bit of the family counselor as I grew up. You probably found this too, Steph. You were the one that everyone came to with their problems and wanted to chat to. And everyone used to say to me, oh, Hannah, you'd be a great psychologist. And I think it probably implanted a little bit in my head. And then when I did my bachelor, I've always been a strong advocate for do what you enjoy and do what you're good at. So I love psychology. I find it really fascinating to learn about why the brain makes us do the weird and wonderful things and sometimes wacky things that we do. But I also think it's really important to find what you're good at life and do that. And so I'm quite good with, I love words. I love writing essays. I love putting words together to explain something in the simplest sentence possible that explains the richest amount of detail for that person. And so psychology is a lot of writing. It is. It's a lot of essay writing. It's a lot of lab report writing. And neuropsychology is a lot of writing as well. So I just was quite good at writing. And I've got a book now. So I just kept moving in the direction of things I enjoy and things that I'm good at. And that just kept, doors kept opening for me. So I was like, I'll do a bachelor. And then the next door opened of honours, and then the next door opened of masters and PhD and writing a book. And it's almost like these breadcrumbs of things just kept dropping down in front of me. And I was like, yep, doing the next thing I enjoy, doing the next thing I'm good at. And that's what led me to being Dr. Han and the author of a book today.
Yeah, that is awesome. And already there's a few good lessons for people in there that, you know, you have to do something you enjoy doing. I think gone are the days that, you know, you can put up with a job and do the 9 till 5. That might have been the previous generation's view on things, but our generation, we really need to be like challenged and enjoying what we're doing. Yeah. Otherwise we can't do it. We'll fail mentally. We can't, we probably don't have that same strength that those previous generations had, but it's also
stoic,
like, what,
grin and bear it.
Yeah. And why not? You know, like, you only got one life, so there's no point. And that was one of my challenges growing up, like trying to, even though I've enjoyed money and investing, I've always, I guess, found it challenging to find that role that really I enjoyed and brought out the fun parts of what I liked. So now I'm pretty happy now doing what I'm doing, but I guess for everyone listening, like, you know, don't stop if obviously Hannah, you were lucky in that you found what you liked straight away. And even for myself, like, I somewhat liked what I was doing before, but I know a lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of people you've met through your psychologist work really struggle with trying to find what it is they like doing. And I guess we're going off a tangent here, but what are some of the ways they can kind of incorporate those two things, I guess, like if they're not sure what they want to do?
Well, let me just say, so many people in my master's year were mature age students, what we call mature age students. So there were people in their 40s and 50s, some people even in their 60s, coming back to uni and learning how to do a master's in psychology so they could go and be a psychologist. Wow. So it's, I think number one, it's never too late. It's never too late. Do not ever fall into the mindset of it's too late for me to go to uni. It's too late for me to start this, because, you know, you think in your head, oh, it's going to take X many years for me to get it done, so I'm not going to bother. Because those years are going to pass whether you like it or not. And you can be chipping away at your goal that you really want to in the background. And then, you know, however many years from that point, you will have that qualification. So I think steering away from this idea that it's too late for me, I can't go back to uni, I can't retrain, I can't try something different. That's the first mentality to lose. Delete it.
Yeah.
Because it's never too late. And tip two and tip three is do what you enjoy and do what you're good at. So it's never too late. Do what you enjoy and do what you're good at. Because if you do the things that you love to do, then it's never going to feel like work. And if you do something that you're good at, then invariably it's going to feel easier and it's not going to feel as laborious and cumbersome and a mental weight on your heart. So if you can find something that incorporates, you know, what you love and what you're good at, then you're on a winning path.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I guess that's those mental blocks we put in for ourselves. I'm coming across it so often at the moment, and sometimes myself, and I have to challenge myself, you know, we set up this, I guess, what's the word? You can't even see it, like invisible barrier that something can't be done, and make an excuse. And I love your attitude. It's get rid of that, you know, excuse do what you love. So, I love that. Now, I guess moving on then, your profile says, I'm going to read this out here. So, see your psychologist to help cut through the BS of life. Obviously the bullshit of life. So, why do you think like we need a psychologist to help with this? Because that's very like, you wouldn't hear that from an old school psychologist. Like, I love it. So why do we need someone to help us cut through the BS of life? And how do you do that, I guess?
Well, yeah, so my handle is No Bull Psych. So my mentality is all about putting psychology into a language that resonates with modern society and people and young people. And it's in a way where we're not, I think sometimes psychology can be siloed into this, put on a pedestal and this ivory tower of like the bourgeois, like, ooh, it's science and it's psychology and it's so fancy and it's for the fancy people in life. But psychology is for everybody. Like, just like you would go to a gym and you would work out your body and you might get a diet and be careful about what you eat, mental health is also something that we need to pay attention to, and we need to be active participants in our own mental health. And I think a lot of people often fall into this idea of, well, I don't have anxiety and I don't have depression and I don't have mental health issues, so I don't need to see a psychologist. But it's a little bit like saying, you know, I don't have a learning disability, so I don't need to go to school, or like, I don't have an allergy, so I don't need a diet, or I don't have a broken arm, so I don't need to go to the gym. No, you don't. You might not have that deficit, so you don't need to have those things. But we still know that going to the gym, having a diet, working out and going to school is enriching and it's going to benefit your life. And if you think about the pie, you know, you've got physical, spiritual, emotional, eating, sleeping, all of these pieces of a pie, you know, a mental, your mental health, your emotional well-being is actually a huge piece of that pie that stems into every other piece of your pie. Because if you feel crummy and if you feel crappy, then anything that you do, that's going to filter into. So if you can get on top of your mental health, if you can have good mental health, then you really have the elite advantage on life. If you can feel good about yourself, and if you can feel good about what you're doing in your life and who you are as a person, and feel good in your heart, in your soul, in your bones, you can feel good about who you are and love yourself, then how good is life, right? Yeah. That is truly the elite advantage on succeeding in life. So if you want to be rich, if you want to be well off, if you want to be, you know, healthy, if you want to be anything successful in life, well, you need to make sure your foundation of you actually loving yourself and you actually liking yourself is good. How do you do that? Well, help, get help. We in Australia, we're so lucky. We have psychologists, we have Medicare rebates. You can go and see a psychologist for free if you want to in Australia. So why not?
Yeah. And I love that. That is like
mic drop.
It is, because that was something I'm going to scrap that from the agenda later. Because I'm going to tie it in here, that I was going to say in my book, you know, for me, when I went to see a psychologist for the first time, say 6-7 years ago, I felt like I was defeated and, you know, I was broken and there was something wrong with me to need to see a psychologist. And one of the things I did with myself is I reinvented what a psychologist was. And for me, just like you said before, you know, you want to be healthy, you go to gym. I said, right, I'm going to the Mind Gym, and this is my personal trainer for my mind. And that was a big part of my book. I don't think you've read it yet. We chatted before. So Redesign Your Mind.
On my to-do list.
Yeah, I know, definitely.
To be read, must be read.
And it was one of the things that I really harped about in the book, that, you know, a psychologist is just your personal trainer for your mind. If you were overweight and you wanted to lose weight and you got a PT and you, you know, started losing weight and getting really fit and healthy, there would be photos splash all over Instagram saying, look at me, look at my body, how good is this? Yet with a psychologist, it was something that would happen in the background and no one were to know. And if you get through it, it's, oh, glad that's over. Like, no one found out about it. We need to redesign how we see psychologists as someone that's going to help us reach our goals. And even though now, you know, I haven't seen one for a while, but I'd love to, you know, there should be like just health checks, kind of, you know, whether it's once every and I hope proactive. And I know COVID's been something that the government's realized, like, mental health is out of control. We need to put more money into it, and I
absolutely
really hope there's more funding for you guys to get in front of more people before it becomes a challenge.
Yeah, at the moment, it's 10 Medicare rebatable sessions per annum, which means you go to your GP and you can get a mental health care plan. So that means you get 6 sessions with your psychologist, and then they write a letter to your GP and you get another 4, and that's paid for by Medicare. So you go to someone who doesn't charge a gap and you don't have to pay any money. And the government has just changed it to 20 sessions under this new COVID legislation. So you can have 20 sessions in a year, which is pretty amazing. Like, that would be, you know, some people could have 2 sessions a week. You could have a session every week for 20 weeks, and you could really smash out some good soul work in that time and really like improve. It's like doing a boot camp for your mind.
It is. And
mental boot camp.
Yeah. You seem like a really positive person, and that's what I'm talking about. Like, we got to go to boot camp. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. And in Australia, take advantage of it. And if you're around the world, I guess, see what's available to you to try and get that support. So I want to use that then to tie into the next question. And I guess it's, what about your own mental health challenges? And, how does a psychologist help themselves? Because you've got all this knowledge and, you know, I guess it might be one of those things that it might be challenging because you've got so many pieces of information you can use. But how do you go about working on your own mental health? And I guess, just some tips there, because some of the listeners love to hear what you would do yourself and some of those challenges you might deal with as a psychologist.
Absolutely.
Being that pressure that you know, you have to be a certain happy level or something like that.
100%. So number one, I see a psychologist as well, and I get to chat about how I'm going and debrief about cases that I've seen that are confronting for me and talk about my own mental health journey, because as you know, Steph, it's hard to have social media and it's hard to be in the media spotlight, and it can be really overwhelming and really confronting. And when you publish a book, so like I've got How to Break Up with Friends, that was scary to put that out and to invest in that and to throw yourself behind something and go, I really hope that I break even, you know, with this investment. So that's stressful. So I talk to a psychologist as well. And I think, and it's been amazing. You know, we chat about how to make sure that my mental health isn't just, you know, below baseline, but once you're at baseline, how to make sure your mental health is getting better and better and better, and you're happier and happier and happier, and that you can maintain this happy disposition all the time. Number two, the thing I love, love, love doing is I journal. Like, I'm holding my journal up right now. You can see it's got this gorgeous picture on the front. This is Alana Fairchild. She's got these beautiful journals and they've got like all these beautiful pictures inside them. I journal like a mad woman. I'm a big fan of Dan Segal, who's the guy who wrote The Whole Brain Child, and it's all about how your brain develops. And it talks about how you integrate your left hemisphere with your right hemisphere by using left hemisphere as language, right hemisphere as emotions. And you integrate the two when you talk your emotions out. So you're integrating your brain when you talk through your emotions. And we're supposed to do this as children, but not all parents are very good at helping children to talk through their emotions. And then we grow up to be adults who don't know how to talk our emotions out. So we're either super analytical robot, and then we flick into being super emotional and having a breakdown, which we've all been there, right? So journaling is a really great way to integrate. It actually improves brain integration, so the interconnections between your hemispheres. So the more you write out how you're feeling and you write out your emotions, the more you're actually integrating your own brain. So those are excellent, super duper tips. Like, number one, I see a psychologist. Yeah. You should see a psychologist. Everyone should see a psychologist. Everyone, in my opinion. And I'm a bias because I am a psychologist. And number two, journal. Very, very important. And number three, do what works for you. Do what works for you. So what works for you, Steph, is different to what works for me, different to what works for Joe Blow. Like, everybody's got their own style. So, you know, if something resonates for you, then go with that. And that might be, you know, you enjoy saging the house and clearing your negative energy. Like, do what works for you. Figure out what makes you feel better and do it. Actually make time to do it. Because that's the problem. We often don't make time for ourselves. Make time for every other person, but we don't make time for ourselves. So figure out what makes you happy and actually do it.
Yeah. Look, that really resonates with me. We've talked a lot about the psychologist thing and the journaling side. So one of the things in my book, I took this from a another book, and it's called Feeling Good by Dr. David Burns, I think, and his talk about rewriting your thoughts. And that's something that I've always been big on, but I haven't done too much with journaling. So hearing you say that is really interesting. So I'd like to hear a bit more. And I'll just touch on the third point before I get you to explain more about journaling. But the third point, that's something in my book I mentioned as well, that, hey, like, you got to keep working on what works for you. Because I remember when I was in the dumps and I would go to people that, you know, like role models to me, and they had nothing. Like, they didn't know what to do. Some of them gave ideas that, you know, worked for them, but was no good for me. So you just got to be on this quest. And that's what the redesign of your mind is, that you're constantly finding what works for you. Because yes, it might even work for you today, but in six months' time, when you might have a relationship or a kid now, or something's changed in your life, that will no longer work and you need to redesign it again. But in terms of journaling, how do you do that? Like, give me and the listeners something there. Because are you just literally just writing out what you're feeling? Are you writing what happened in the day? Do you summarize it? How do you, let's say it's tonight or tomorrow morning, what do you do with your journaling?
Well, firstly, there's really no rules on journaling. It's not about, you know, there's no, like, if you're doing it this way, you're doing it wrong. And if you're doing it this way, you're doing it right. It's just about actually taking time to sit with yourself. So often, I think the crux of mental health is that we don't give ourselves time to take care of our own mental health. We give everybody else time. And listeners probably sitting here going, like, how many times have you committed to giving your time, your energy, and your money away, which you couldn't actually afford? You know, driving someone to the airport, promising to help someone move their house, going to that brunch when you know you actually needed to stay home and do your assignment or your own work, helping family members, helping friends, helping everyone. You're staying up to 1 in the morning to chat to a friend who's having a tough time, even though you're utterly exhausted and burnt out and you need sleep. We're so good at putting ourselves last and not putting ourselves in any meaningful way first, because it comes across as selfish to put yourself first. And people think, I couldn't possibly spend the money on myself or spend the time or put the energy into myself, because it's so, so easy to fall in the habit of putting everyone else first. So really, journaling is just an opportunity for you to take some time out for you and change the relationship you have with your own emotions. So this idea of depression, anxiety, sadness, those emotions are seen as negative, bad emotions. They're not bad emotions. No emotion is bad. Emotions are just functions that help protect you in this life. So sadness, depression, anxiety, stress, they serve a purpose to protect you from, you know, the car coming towards you. You need to get out of the way. From the dangerous salesman who's trying to sell you a beat up Volkswagen that you don't need to buy. Those alarm bells going off, that stress, that anxiety, those are things to tell you, stop, stop doing this. This is hurting me. Don't do this. This is your heart saying, awooga, awooga, alert, alert, alert. Don't do it. Don't do it, right? So we need to learn to listen to those feelings and hear what they're actually telling us, because that's your gut instinct. That is your intuition telling you, please don't do this anymore because it's actually hurting me. And we get really, really good at not listening to that little voice inside
us.
Shove it down. Exactly. Because you have expectations from other people who want you to do things. You have work colleagues and bosses and university assignments and partners who want you to do stuff that you might not really want to do. So, and you might've been raised in an environment where things happened to you that weren't fair and it wasn't just, and it hurt you, but you had to survive. You had to be complicit. You had to allow things to occur to survive and to get through that environment. And that means we suppress those feelings of listening to our heart when it says, don't do this. This is hurting me, or this is making me sad, or this is making me stressed. So when you sit with yourself, what you're doing is changing the relationship you have with your own feelings. So instead of going, oh, emotion, sadness, anxiety, depression. I don't like you. I don't want to think about you. I want to push you away and distract myself from you. We're very good at distracting ourselves. Mm. Instead of distracting yourself and not listening to those emotions, journaling forces you to sit with yourself, no one else, and have a conversation with yourself, a conversation with just you, because you're writing your own thoughts. So you're talking to yourself, and whatever needs to come out is going to come out in that conversation. And you can make it more structured, and you can write a topic that you want to talk about. You can ask yourself questions, or you can just write to some beautiful music. Whatever gets those words to come out on the page, it doesn't really matter. All that matters is you give yourself the space and the opportunity to speak out. Why am I feeling sad? Why am I feeling anxious? Why am I feeling depressed? Why am I feeling stressed out? Because what will come out on the page is the reason why, the source, the cause, why is this happening, and how do I actually feel about it? And then you can walk away from that session and know, okay, I understand myself a little bit better. And now I can think about what my possible solutions are to this issue.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. It's really that, acknowledging as well, you know, what something that was challenging for me, I wouldn't acknowledge, or, you know, these anxious thoughts were coming out in, you know, I had like sore necks and aches, and I was getting sick and things like that, because I was ignoring it.
The body speaks the mind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this journaling is another way to kind of connect with that. And maybe sometimes it's just letting it out. Sometimes you might write it out and then find that, hey, I'm actually, you know, I'm on the wrong path, or maybe I'm just worrying over nothing. I definitely am going to give journaling a go, and I'm going to start right after this. Let's challenge the readers, mm-hmm. the listeners and watchers, and, you know, give journaling a go, and maybe, you know, in the comments or something on Instagram, or email in, and you know, say how you guys went with journaling as well, because I think it's a great way.
Give it a try.
It's
talk
something
to yourself.
Yeah, I've talk never done. I have done similar things, but I guess journaling for me, the other thing that would worry me, and this is the anxious part, I guess, of, you know, I'm just thinking already, like people being let into my thoughts. Like, it's like in the movies, like what if someone reads your journal? Like what do you do when you finish a journal?
Oh my God.
Yeah. What have you found that most people do, or what do you do, or some tips there?
It's actually so funny you said that, Steph, because I suggest it all the time to people. Like, are you journaling? What do you mean you're not journaling? You should be journaling. Like, I'm such a journaling advocate. I'm like all about journaling. Because of the intricate, because I'm neuroscience to the max. I'm like, you're interconnecting your brain. Come on, guys. And people often say to me, oh my God, but what if somebody reads it? And I'm like, what? Where are you living, mate? Like, who's reading your journal? I've never encountered anyone who's actually said to me, somebody read my journal. Like, number one, if somebody reads your journal, they are an a-hole. Like, oh my God, how rude. Like, that's on them. And whatever they read, that's more of a reflection of them than it is of you. So I would just turn that right around and say, what kind of jerk are you that you read my diary? And number two, let's be real. Like, honestly, if you don't want somebody to read something, it's so easy. Like, don't use that as an excuse. Come on now, you're using that as an excuse not to journal. It's so easy to put this somewhere safe that no one's going to read it, or destroy what you write. It can be super cathartic to go and take what you've written and go and do a beautiful ritual with yourself. You know, go and sit in the moonlight and burn what you've written, and do this ritual behavior where you're seeing in yourself, whether you believe in it or you don't believe in it or whatever, the process of doing something that feels deeply meaningful. Like, I'm burning this, and the intention is I'm letting it go. I'm clearing it from myself, whether it's symbolic, whether it's spiritual, whether it's whatever. That process can be quite cathartic and quite a really beautiful process for you to go through. So if you're worried someone's going to read it, you know, go and burn it, destroy it, do whatever you want, and use that as part of the process where you feel like you've been cleared and cleansed and you've let go of whatever it is that you just wrote about.
Yeah, that's awesome. Awesome. Love it.
No excuses here. No BS.
That's right.
BS psychologist. I'm not going to put up with any excuses. Yeah.
So I want to ask then, before we get onto your book, I want to ask, so with neuroscience and what you've learned as well, one stigma or challenge I find against people, they often say like someone is just the way they are and they'll never change, and or you'll never change, or you might say yourself, oh, it's just how I am. Do you, through your research and your work, do you believe, I've got my thoughts, but I want the professional's thoughts. Do you believe people can change and develop those new neurons and pathways? So for example, someone might be listening now, they might be negative and, you know, they're always depressed and they don't like the way they feel, and not saying it's right to not like how you feel, but they might want to improve or change. Do you think that's possible to change your mindset and thought processes over time?
Well, for others, are we talking like, do you believe within yourself you can change?
For you, yeah. For someone listening out there. 100%.
100%. 100%. Like I'm neuropsychology. I'm neuroscientist. I believe in neuroplasticity. The brain is neuroplastic. It changes forever over the course of your life. Even in your 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, your brain is always, always changing. It's how, if you're alive and your eyes are open, then your brain is doing something. So you always have the propensity and possibility for change and growth. And the number one predictor, they say, with lots of meta-analyses, which are just studies that take lots and lots of studies and put them together to be super powerful, the number one predictor in psychological therapy about which therapy do we use and what works, should I use CBT or DBT or ACT therapy or whatever different therapy it is, the number one predictor is not the therapy that was used, it's actually the individual's belief that they want to change and that they're ready to change. So if you believe inside yourself, I want to change and I am ready to change, that is one of the strongest predictors that you will actually move down a path of changing, and that you will have the motivation and the gumption to go and do the stuff, go and do the work, go and do the emotional work to make it happen. That is one of the biggest predictors. So if you're sitting here and you're listening to this and you're feeling that inkling in your heart that I'm ready, I want something different, I want to know what this girl is talking about, what is she talking about, what's this, what's Stefan talking about when he says the trainer of your mind, like what is this stuff? If you're feeling that inclination, follow it, because that is that is the start of your journey where you are getting the motivation uniquely for you that makes you want to change and grow. And again, it's never too late. You're not set in your ways. It's not old dogs can't learn new tricks. That's not true. You can change. You can grow. Your brain is ready and wants to learn. It wants to change. It wants to grow. It wants to develop. So you have all the nuts and bolts ready to go there because your brain wants to learn. It wants to develop. All you have to do is feed it the right information and you will change and you will grow. Every day you're forming patterns. So what pattern do you want to grow and form into going forward? The flip side of that is when we look at other people and we go, will these other people change? Can I make somebody else change?
That can't happen. No. And that's something.
You cannot change someone else.
No, that's right.
They have to change for themselves.
Exactly. And that's one big problem with relationships. Like people want their partner to change or whatever. And it ties in with the first thing you said. If you've got the belief and the desire to change, very good chance you will. Now, if you're saying to someone else, you need to change this, well, first of all, they might not have the belief, but most importantly, they probably don't have the desire to do what you're telling them to. Mm-hmm. So that ties in perfectly. So for me, that was one thing that really helped me when I was, you know, anxious and eventually depressed as well. I thought, well, if I've changed from a real positive, happy, you know, ambitious person to this person, surely I can change again. And for me, that's a big driver of this quest to redesign my mind and constantly improve, because, you know, an easy way, a layman's terms, layman's way of explaining it for me is that if you want to start, you know, making, doing woodwork or playing a sport, you don't say, "Oh, I'm 40. I can't learn how to play badminton. It's too late."
Mm.
You can go mm-hmm. out and get a coach mm. or golf or whatever mm-hmm. it is, get a coach mm. and watch mm-hmm. some YouTube videos and start.
Yeah.
There's nothing absolutely. Stopping you. So it's the same for your mind. And I'm really,
it's about discipline, isn't it?
Yeah.
Discipline.
And it's, yeah. it's also that want. I agree 100% mm. with you that, you know, when I was in the dumps and coming out of it, I really wanted it. You know, I said,
yeah,
something for me, I just wanted to be, you know, just mm. one day of being on the beach, sitting on a beach, happy, just carefree. Mm. And that meant everything to me. And that was something yeah. I was going to work on. And
yep.
for other people listening, if you are in those positions, you have to think of what it is, what's your meaning, what's your why, you know, why is it that you want to change? And if you can find that,
yeah,
you'll get there. But I want to move on to your book because, yeah, we've had some great conversation and I want to talk about the book. So it's called How to Break Up with Friends. And yeah, maybe give a bit of a quick intro on it because I've got some mm. questions that might explain sure. part of the book. But yeah, what yeah. can readers and listeners on Audible expect?
So I guess it comes down to a very common phenomenon of people that we don't talk about a lot, which is toxic friends. So having mm. friends who are passive aggressive, friends who bring you down, friends who make you feel worse after an interaction than before you saw them, the friend that's passive aggressive and says nasty comments to you, or the friend that's take, and they seem to be sucking up a lot of your time and your money, or they're only ever there when they need something, or mm. they're just essentially a drain on you and making you feel crummy and making you question your self-worth or your choices in life. And they're not enriching you in any way. They're hurting you. And you walk away from those interactions feeling saddened mm. and insulted or offended, or you have lower self-worth after you've interacted with this person who is supposed to be someone who you hold very close to your heart. And this is actually a really, really common issue that we don't talk about a lot. Mm. So the book is all about acknowledging that what is a good friendship, firstly, realizing that it's perfectly reasonable for you to have expectations of your friends, that you expect them to behave like a friend and treat you with courtesy, respect, trust, affection, you know, basic things. We're not talking about them buying you a yacht or something. We're talking about the basic things you can expect from a friend. Yeah. And then realizing if a behavior is inappropriate, how to actually communicate that. And if nothing changes, how to go about a breakup with a friend.
Yeah, well, and I'm literally going to order this book. Where can we get the book? Besides Audible,
So Audible's great. You can have a listen. If you're not on Audible, I think the first download is free, which is awesome. But it's in all good bookshops. So like Dimmicks, Big W, all the bookshops in Australia are stocking it at the moment. But you can also get it online if you want to read it on Kindle or Booktopia, Book Depository, Amazon. It's basically everywhere. So you can get your hands on a copy. I'd love to hear people's thoughts. People have been sharing a lot of their friendship experiences mm. on my Instagram at NoBullPsych, and it's been amazing to hear how common this actually is and that mm. we don't talk about it.
Yeah, and I'll put all your socials and details in the show notes so people can get in contact with you and share their experiences too. I guess you know, recently, so I've been dating my girlfriend for about a year now, and it's funny because I've been single for, I think I was single for 10 years before I got with her. So it's a new world, or it's been a new world for me. And you're connecting with, you know, you're figuring out who you as a couple now connect with as friends. Mm. And mm. I said to her early on in the piece, because we've both got big sets of friends, I said, well, let's just see, you know, who we connect with and who likes us and we like them. And that's who we're going to spend our time and energy on, because there's just too many people these days. And I'm probably, you know, the old me probably wanted so much connection with friends. And so it's been a transition for me.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, one thing, and you can comment on that too. I would like to know, this is for my personal life, what do you do about, you might have friends that you want to break up with, and you'll have to read the book for that, everyone listening, so go and get a copy. But what about those friends that you don't want to break up with, but you know, maybe when you're with them, you enjoy their company, but that you don't feel they put any effort in with you, and you see them putting in effort with other people. And when you catch up, it's great. you catch up, it's great, but you might feel that you're not as special to them as they are to you.
So what you're describing is essentially the hierarchy of intimacy in friendship. So I talk a lot about the science of friendship in the book. And one of the things we discuss is the Dunbar number, which is how many friends your brain is theorized to actually be able to handle. So how many close relationships. And the idea is that you have levels of intimacy. And the more close the relationship, the more complex it is, and the fewer people your brain can handle on that level. So in terms of really, really close relationships, it's theorized that your brain can only handle 5 really, really, really close relationships. So this is like your girlfriend, your mother, your child, the people you see every day. And that makes sense, because you only have so much time in the day, right, to see people and actually interact with people. Yeah. And the less intimate the relationship, the more people you can handle on that level. So you can have, you know, 15 closer friends and 25 less close friends, and so on and so forth. So it's essentially a hierarchy, right? You may be placing someone higher on the hierarchy than they have placed you. And what that means is you might be giving time, energy, and money to that friend at a really high level, but they are giving a really low level of their time, energy, and money. So we talk about cost benefit analysis in the book, and how it's everything we do is a cost benefit analysis. Do I call that? Oh, I see that Johnny has called me. Do I call Johnny back? Well, that depends on how much you perceive that Johnny is going to be a worthwhile conversation, or would you rather go and sit on the couch and watch Netflix and eat some dinner and chill out, right? So we are always assessing whether it's worth the interaction for us. And and we talk about this in the book, why do friends treat us? I've got a chapter on different friend mentalities and why friends sometimes treat us poorly. And one of them is that they've put you on a lower hierarchy rank than you put them. So you're putting in there's a mismatch between how much effort you're putting in and how much effort they're putting in. And the answer to that is, unfortunately, sometimes you do just need to recognize it for what it is, which is, we have a great time when we catch up every 6 months, and that's what it is. We have a drink and it's lovely, but you need to reassess how much time, energy, and money you're putting in, because you might be putting way too much in.
Yeah, I love that. And I can't wait to read the book, because I think that is another a big mental health challenge. And you've obviously recognized that. And for me, I spent years getting my own mental health to a position that I'm very happy with it. And it's still, you've always got to work and evolve on it. But I think the next step is I'm sure you talk about this in the book, that it's your relationships with those around you. And that's what's challenging. And maybe, you know, I don't know if you use this quote, but someone I know always says it, that you've got friends for a reason and friends for a season. And maybe some of those people were friends for a season, that's it. And now you've got new friendships to develop.
Yeah. And I think something that I often find gives people a lot of comfort is because there's a lot of pressure on us in society with Instagram and Facebook to be popular and appear like we have lots of friends and we're very social. But the literature actually tells us that, you know, to get the positive effects of good friendship, which is, you know, more success, better cardiovascular health, staving off dementia, better academic and financial success in the future. There's amazing, I have a chapter on the benefits of good friends. It's not about, the literature says very clearly, it's not about the quantity of friends. It's not about the number of friends you have. It's about the quality of the friend. So fewer, truer friends is far more powerful than having oodles and oodles of mediocre friends, right?
Yeah.
So you don't need to have heaps of friends to get the benefits of having friendship. You actually just need one or two really, really good friends to get the benefits of friendship. And it's really normal and healthy to have a few really close friends. So don't be fooled into thinking because of social media that, you know, if you're not standing in front of a balloon garland on a yacht with your monogrammed cupcakes with your 50 best friends standing behind you, there's something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. That's not normal to have that many friends. It's totally normal to have a couple of really good friends. That's totally normal.
Yeah. And that's something for me. I'm sure as you get older as well, that your friendship group comes down, and that's been that transition for me that has been challenging. Like, I'm used to having, let's say, probably 8 or 9 real close friends, and that is coming down. I think it's one of those things that we have to work on. And like you'll talk about in the book. One thing I'd like to ask as well, not sure if you, your thoughts on this, but what about, do you think it's something as well we need to accept that someone might be a close friend at one point, and now that friendship is not so close? It doesn't mean that that friendship wasn't meaningful. It still was meaningful, but now we've got new close friends, and maybe those close friends will change again. We don't need to put this pressure that if our close friends, that's it for the rest of time.
No, not at all. And longevity doesn't equal quality. So it's not uncommon for people to go, oh, they're a childhood friend. I've known them for years. I've known them for decades. And I can't possibly break up with them or put less time in because they're my childhood friend. But actually that friend might be treating you rather poorly, taking a lot from you and not giving you very much back in the relationship. So longevity doesn't necessarily equal quality. So it's normal for you to, for friendships to ebb and flow. We actually call it didactic withdrawals, which is where your didactic energy, the energy of who you are, who is Stefan today? Today, Stefan is a podcast host, an author, a writer. This is who you are, a new boyfriend. That's your identity now. Whereas, you know, 5 years ago, it might have been university Stefan, at university Steph. It might have been going to the pub and having daiquiris with your mate. and in the future, it could be becoming a father, becoming a new parent. And one day it would be retirement. So you actually, your energy goes into a different identity at the different stages of life that you're in. And we find that our worlds tend to gravitate towards the people who are going through the same identity changes that we are. So when you become a parent, you'll make a lot of new parent friends. When you're at uni, you make a lot of uni friends. When you're going through retirement, you'll make a lot of people who are also going through retirement friends. It's all about, and it's normal for you to ebb and flow. So some points in your life, you're not going to have so many friends because you need that energy to go towards being a new parent and keeping the baby alive. And you don't have time to go for coffees and beers with your mates. So you might not have a lot of friends at that stage in your life. But then later in life, you come back into those circles when your children are all teenagers. And that's totally normal as well. So it's very, very normal for some points in your life to look around and go, oh my gosh, I don't feel like I have that many friends. That's not unusual. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, but you do need to make sure that you're taking the time in your schedule to set aside time for those relationships. And it is very common for us when we get caught up in work goals and family goals and relationship goals to forget about ourselves and to put everyone else first and not schedule time to see our mates. So this is not a hall pass to never put effort in with your friends. You do need to still put effort in with your friends and preserve those relationships. So if you've got a good mate who keeps calling you and wants to catch up, make sure that you schedule, you know, put aside an hour or once a month to catch up with your mates. And that's okay to do that.
And I guess with that as well, like, is there a way to, I guess, let's say maybe you've let a friendship go a little bit and you haven't put in enough effort, or there's someone that maybe, you know, that you both haven't put the effort in. Is there a way, or is this something you talk about in the book or your own thoughts on how you can kind of cultivate that and give it a rebirth and say, look, you know what, what are some of the ways we can make that happen and give it a rebirth?
Yeah. So we do talk about in the book, you know, how we speak to people, how we communicate our needs to people. I have an app, it's called Assert Yourself, and it gives you lines on how to actually say what you need from a friend.
Oh, wow.
So it's all about operating with integrity. You know,
sorry, does the book talk about that as well, the app?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, great.
So it's all about whatever coming out of your mouth is done with integrity and grace. So sometimes we do have falling outs with friends, or we do drift apart from friends, and then later, many years later, our paths realign and we come back together. Mm. If you know that whatever you've said to that friend, whatever you've done with that friend, it's always been with integrity, then you know that when you see them again, you can always hold your head up high and you can say, "Hey, mate, how are you?" Because what you said to them before the friendship dwindled was always respectful and kind. So I suppose number one, make sure you're always speaking with integrity and whatever comes out of your mouth is based on integrity. Number two, everybody wants to connect, right? In Australia, I think, you know, one of the leading studies on loneliness in Australia, the loneliness survey, which is done by Swinburne in 2019, said that 50% of the population is feeling lonely. And that's a bleak statistic, but also we can flip that on its head. We can look at it the other way around, which is every second person that you see wants to connect more. So it's probably likely that your mate would love or welcome a message from you saying, "Hey mate, I've been thinking about you. You know, sorry we haven't caught up in a long while. I just want to hear how things are going for you. I'd love to have a chat, love to have a coffee if you're free." And if you think about that, Steph, like if you got a nice message from someone you hadn't heard from in a long time saying, "Hey, I'm thinking about you. I know it's been a really long time, but you're on my mind. I hope that you're doing well. I'd love to have a coffee date or a call catch up when you've got a free chance. No stress if not, but I hope you're well and I'm thinking about you. I'm sending positive vibes your way." You know, how lovely is that? Like people generally, people like messages like, so you can always reach out and just see where it goes.
And another thing, and we'll wrap it up in a couple minutes. Another thing with what you said there that I'm not very good at, that I'm working on, is I probably put that pressure on someone. So I think you said there, you said something like, "No stress if you're busy" or whatever. Mm. That's empowering them to say, "Hey, like if they're free or if they're not free, they'll think about you." And then you can adjust the hierarchy accordingly depending on what they say. But you haven't guilted them into catching up either, which is something I need to work on.
Send a nice message. You can start off, "How are you doing, mate? I'm thinking about you. Hope you're doing well." And they can reply. And if it's a nice message, "I'm thinking about you too. It'd be great to catch up." You know, maybe it's just having a quick 5-minute phone call. And maybe that phone call turns into a coffee. And maybe that coffee turns into a regular catch up. You know, you never know. But don't put too much pressure on yourself and just put the feelers out.
No, Hannah, I love it. And look, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm sure everyone will get a lot out of this episode. So for those that didn't catch it, the book is called How to Break Up with Friends by Dr. Hannah Carell. And I'll put all the socials and info in the show notes so you can get in contact with Hannah there as well. Hannah, thanks so much for coming on, and thanks again.
Thank you, Steph, and have a lovely new year. Happy 2021.
You too. All right, thanks. What a chat with Dr. Hannah Carell. Her book, How to Break Up with Friends, is out in all good bookstores and also on Audible. I'll be purchasing a copy myself. And I think we could all learn a lot from that book. I found that conversation really interesting. So, one of the key takeaways for me is about how Hannah herself sees a psychologist. So it ties in with that theme that it's not scary or bad or anything negative with seeing a psychologist. They are just personal trainers for your mind. And the more we can get that into our heads and this understanding that mental health is just something to keep working on, the stronger and better we'll be with our happiness and mental health. So Thanks for listening, guys. And if you're on YouTube, thanks for watching. Looking forward to the next episode.